With two Olympic golds, an Olympic silver, and seven world titles to his name, Australia's Matt Belcher is the most successful 470 sailor of all time. So in this week's Q&A with Road to Gold, we'll be asking this serial winner to share his secrets on what has made him such a dominant force in the Olympic doublehander. Before we introduce Matt, hi, my name's Andy Rice. I'm back in the UK from the Canary Islands, so back in cold old Winchester. Hamish, how's things with you in New Zealand?
Yeah, all good, thanks, and good morning, good evening, everyone. Yeah, I'm back on dry land again as well, and I'm really excited to have Matt, and looking forward to hearing some gold nuggets. We're waiting anxiously here for a grandchild number two, and I know Matt's in a similar situation over there in Australia.
Hi, Matt. Welcome
Hi,
on the
hey
call.
Hey, guys, how are you? Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so it is awesome to have you at any time, but particularly when child number four is imminent, it's particularly kind of you to join us. And so obviously, if you have to run, you have to run. But hopefully we've got you here for the next 60 minutes, Matt.
I think that's pretty safe for the next 60 minutes. I'll be all right.
Good. Now, did I add enough world titles to the introduction? Is it seven?
It's eight 470s.
Eight. I should have asked before we got on the call. Sorry. I mean, what's the odd 470 world titles to be left off a list? Anyway, congratulations most recently on Tokyo. And I guess for everybody, you included, there must have been a lot of unknowns. With what level of confidence did you come into Tokyo 2020?
Yeah, you know, I think everyone, particularly on the call, like most of those Olympic sailors, trying to rearrange your program coming into Tokyo. Like the confidence that we had, I wouldn't say it was overly confident. It was enough that we knew that once we had a high pressure situation like the Games, that we knew we'd be okay. We were definitely going to be in the mix. But the biggest concern for us was just the lack of racing. And I think that was predominantly the Australia and New Zealand's COVID response, which really made it quite difficult for us to be able to get overseas, to be able to train. And that was really, you know, that was really the biggest thing for us, was just to get as much racing as we could. And we knew if we could get that racing and we could get those skills enough to race against the top guys, then we would probably, you know, be in the mix. And you know, the games is just a totally a different event than most. So very happy that it obviously worked out for us. But you know, the key thing was just to getting over to Europe and finally getting those approvals to do the Europeans. And that was a big eye opener for us. And I'm sure for the Kiwis, and being able to partner together coming back in Australia to do some training together was really helpful in our preparation.
What were the nerves like on day one, just before the start of race one?
Yeah, you know, I always get nervous. I think it doesn't really matter what the competition, and I think it just because it means so much. You know, when we talk about Olympic campaigning, you know, obviously you're representing your country, you're representing your family, your sailing community, your friends. And for me, when I get a little bit nervous, I get excited. It's kind of a trigger for me to know that it's really important and what I'm doing is it matters. And also to remember, you know, don't stuff it up. It's kind of that sort of day one process. And I think the more times you're in that situation, you know, the better you handle that kind of pressure. The day one of London was a little bit of a disaster for us. We came into that event winning all the events that year. And I remember day one quite clearly. We started the race quite nervous, race one, came around to the top mark, hit the top mark, had to do a penalty, finished the race, still quite a good position. And then race number two, the same day, we were over the line. We came back. Then we probably saw one of the best races I've ever raced. Came back to I think, to fifth position for the last top mark in about 25 knots. And then we didn't see another boat as we were launching the spinnaker and had to do a 720. So it's just a lot of those little mistakes that happen. And I think the key to handling that is just not letting those little mistakes escalate to something that turns into a major. And day one for us, you know, we be able to settle really quickly and you know, get into a good rhythm. And I think we saw that throughout the week.
So sailing with Malcolm Page at London 2012, him coming off the back of an Athens 2004 regatta, sorry, not off the back of that was off the back of winning gold, but I just think he won in 2008 with Nathan Wilmot, but by Malcolm's own admission, he learned not to win an Olympic medal in Athens 2004. Did Malcolm bring any of that up with you on day one of London 2012?
Yeah, I mean, of course, and I think the fortunate thing for me is just having so many great people around me to be able to guide in the right direction and to utilize their experience to not remake those mistakes, and to have, you know, your sailing partner who was a 3 times world champion before teaming up an Olympic champion. It just gives you so much confidence. And even though London was my first games, you know, as a partnership, we had a lot of experience, particularly when your coach, Victor, who's been with me since I was a 17, 18-year-old kid. So to have that relationship and that group around you, you know, not to mention my wife and the Australian sailing community to guide you. And when you make those mistakes, you know, and I remember on day one in London, Victor put his arm around me, and you know, we're a little bit sad about those results, and he put me around and he said, geez, you really stuffed that up, but good, tomorrow, you know, you've got it out of the way, and let's just get on with it. And I think just that underlying confidence, that drive that you have, or that you do build in your partnerships, just get you through those you know, those difficult moments.
And we saw a number of people at Tokyo 2020 have a pretty hard day of it on day one. Matt Wern comes to mind. I don't know why it is. I've seen so many amazing comebacks, but I'm one of those people that tends to reach that easy conclusion that, oh, they're done. You know, that old cliche that you can't win the regatta on day one, but you can lose it. And Matt Wern looked like one of those people that maybe after all that expectation was not going to come through, and then he wins with a medal race to spare. I mean, that mentality of not giving up is one of the things that marks people out. And I'm wondering, were you born with that? Did you always have that, or is that a learned skill for you?
I think it's a learned skill. Some of it comes within your upbringing, I think, and the group and the environment that you're subject to. But if you're a competitive athlete, which if you're at the games, you're obviously very competitive, you're very skilled and you're at the best. And I think, you know, the Australian sailing team have a really great culture, but certainly, you know, the coaches, your friends around you and that drive that motivates you. And, you know, I was rooming next to Maddie and had breakfast with him every day. And I remember, you know, we talk about rhythm and day one, and I think some of it can be just as simple as getting the right conditions on day one. If you get, you know, the right conditions for your team, or and it's a little bit of an easy introduction into the event, that can be as simple as just starting off well, getting your confidence, and then building from that. And I remember looking out the window on day one of Matt's day and thinking, oh my God, I'm so happy we're not starting today. You know, it was offshore conditions and it was what, 5 to 7 knots, and just such a tricky day to start with, can be really hard to you know, build that momentum. But you know, Matty showed his character, and he showed his you know, I guess his approach, and with Michael and with the Australian, I guess with the Australian sailing team, was able to regroup and just show you how difficult their event was overall in the lasers for their conditions. that the results were up and down, that they he had the opportunity to come back?
Hamish, the lack of research time was an issue for everybody other than the Japanese, that sailing time at Enoshima. How much did that affect your build-up with Pete and Blair? And I'd like to come back to Matt and hear your view on that afterwards.
Yeah, well, it's Japan's pretty familiar for me, so I felt like I understood the conditions we were going to get. But I kind of feel also looking back that I might have failed to really give that to the boys, because we were all a bit scarred by the test events, and the 470 Worlds were there as well at the same time. And I think, you know, we got kind of I think the whole fleet across all classes got a bit overwhelmed by the sort of big waves, big wind sort of scenarios we saw in the build-up the previous 3 years. So, you know, we might have, I think, you know, all of us might have overcooked that slightly. And it was very hard to know what we were going to get. But, you know, having spent a lot of time in Japan over the, you know, over my life, really, since I was 18, you know, I do remember most of the time was light sea breezes, and that's sort of what we ended up hitting. And probably, you know, just needed to come back to that a bit more in terms of getting prepared. We were just a little undercooked on the racing, like everybody was. And I think certainly in those light sea breezes, it's a different style of racing. But everybody had a different regatta. It'd be really interesting to hear what Matt's got to say with the 470s at a different start time.
Yeah, you know, as Hamish said, it's hard to get that kind of competition and that volume of boats to do a lot of domestic-based training. And I think for us as a team, we've really had to have an international approach, that we traveled a lot. We did all the events, and I know that probably surprised a lot of teams over the years, that for a good 15 years, we basically did every event that we could. And we were preparing our program based on an international competition schedule. It made it difficult with time away, and it made it difficult with family, but it was about getting enough competitions and getting the right environment to learn, whether that's, you know, whether that's starting, whether that's psychology, whether that's tactics or strategy or speed work. We just needed the boats. And for us coming into Rio was quite difficult, because with being in Rio and the distance it took to actually get over there and the added difficulty of running a European program, it made it very hard to actually do anything, yeah, basically do anything domestically for us. So we, after that campaign, we really decided we needed to partner with Japanese teams. We needed to try and build a better knowledge of the conditions. And we set up a partnership with the two Japanese teams, which allowed us to much more access to Enoshima, and it also gave us a really an amazing platform to have a strong level of partnership, training partners, confidentiality as well, to be able to do a lot of our testing outside of, I guess, the European group, and gave us that a little bit of that security and that support. So we went to Japan a lot. We were there probably about 4 or 5 times a year over the years, and I think we clocked up about 15 times this quad, and you know, even though with the last couple of years, I think the test event or the World Cup was the last time we were able to get over to Japan, we felt really comfortable that we knew the conditions, we'd seen a lot of the conditions before, and had a pretty deep understanding of, I guess, what to expect come games time.
Wow, impressive. So it sounds like bar the Japanese, you pretty much practiced on that venue as anybody else, and obviously a high priority for you. How much did you develop your equipment specifically for the venue?
We developed it a little bit, I guess, for, you know, for our approach. We tried to stay away with anything that was going to be overly complicated or had the potential to be quite either extremely fast or quite slow in other conditions. So we were really, a lot of the development with our equipment was more about usage, was about making the gear changing easier, making it more versatile across a wind range. For us, you know, we're not the lightest team. And, you know, we were certainly developing and building our strength in lighter conditions. And that was always a weak area for us, or an area that we really wanted to focus on. We'd love strong wind. We spent a lot of time in wind and wavy conditions in Australia, but getting those sort of really light, tricky conditions that we typically short chop would have in Europe. So a lot of our sail package was developed for lighter conditions. And we did sacrifice speed in stronger conditions, but we knew that Nick's, with Will's amazing size and crew work, that he would be able to, you know, get us around the course in the top few, and then, you know, we can race from there.
It surprises me. I'm sure it's well known within the 470 circles if you were one of the heavier teams, but bearing in mind how much the kinetics changed, and I would have thought encouraged heavier teams, surely you were even more heavy for the Rio cycle than you were for the Tokyo cycle, bearing in mind the kinetics weren't as strong then.
Yeah, we were significantly heavier for Tokyo than we were for Rio. And that's part of experience. You know, this fleet dynamic of having really light crews combined has always been a struggle for myself to be able to get down to weight. And the same for Will. And, you know, for Rio, we took it too far. We really tried to, we felt that we needed to be as light as we physically could, and to the point where, you know, when we do our national testing, we always get these calls say, hey, you know, you guys are way too skinny here. And I think the interesting part was that for this campaign, we just said, we're just going to be comfortable. We're going to be light, but we just want to be comfortable. And if that meant that we were 5 kilos heavier, then so be it. And I think that approach really helped us at the games, that it wasn't a factor for us. It wasn't something that we were, you know, maybe a kilo and a half, 2 kilos overweight, and we really needed to lose weight quickly before the games. We never even weighed ourselves. We weighed it individually. We never talked about it as a team, and we just trusted each other to the point that we just got on with it and sort of disregarded it. And we were probably about 6 kilos heavier than we were in Rio. So a fair substantial difference in weight, but I think our light wind performance actually increased. So it's just one of those things.
And so why was that? I see the dynamic comments in the chat box echoing exactly what I was thinking, John, about what Joe Alley said on one of these Q&A calls a few weeks ago. But what were you looking to get back by sitting at a higher weight? Was it partly sort of feeling better in yourself physically and mentally?
Yeah, it was about the psychology for us. And I think this is very individual. Depends on where you are, your size. We certainly weren't going and eating hamburgers and having beers in the bar, that's for sure. But it was something that we knew that we could, the fatigue as an event went on, we knew that COVID in particular had its own dynamic. There'd be a lot of complexity on land, not just the usual Olympic environment that you would deal with typically. So with all of these other concerns and the worries, that we just wanted to make sure that we could handle that week, we could maintain a good rhythm for the week, that we were healthy, which was also another one, that we were constantly getting sick once we were down to extreme weight loss. So we just felt more comfortable. We were happier. Just the usual things when, for those of the, you know, your partners, just wanting to be in a better state of mind coming into it.
Hamish, this seems to be a recurring theme, and I'm sure you got some views on this, the debate about so-called perfect weight for a boat compared with your ideal weight as a functioning human being. What's your view?
Yeah, I think that functioning human being, I mean, I had a similar experience with Dave Barnes, the late Dave Barnes, you know, he's a bit like Matt. You know, he was a solid guy. Naturally, we call him big boned, heavy boned, and it was always better. We always sound better when he was heavier, and I'm sure a lot of it we weren't really digging deep into it, but I'm sure a lot of it was psychological. But Dave always maintained that when we were a more similar weight, we sailed the boat better, the boat balanced better, you know, when he was heavier. And it made him happy. And we tried other options, but in the end, it was just, you know, the way that he naturally felt good at was always our best fighting weight. So I can totally understand what Matt's saying there. And, you know, I think if you had to sort of summarize, and it might be a generalization, but in my mind, I sort of feel like being in a slightly overweight in the class and sailing very well in lighter winds is often a better scenario than being underweight and then having to battle harder, you know, when you're overpowered. And for most boats, you know, you're overpowered and 8 knots. And so generally, you spend a lot more time above 8 knots than you do below 8 knots. So that being on the heavier side is a little more rewarding. And being on the lighter side.
Yeah, well, there's much more we could get into there, Matt. And I'm thinking what Malcolm Page must have said to you about the 2008 games. I'm saying with Nathan, who's a tall guy, tall enough to be a helm in his own right. But I actually, who I do want to ask you about is, did you take heart from maybe that you could be heavier and didn't need to be the ideal size from the way that Shimi Fantella and Igor Marinich managed to win the gold medal in Rio, completely the wrong way round? I mean, the tall guy at the back and the short guy on the trapeze. How did you and Will and Victor make sense of that?
I think, you know, Shimi and Igor are just, you know, just amazing guys and close friends through our time of Olympic and you know, I was really happy that he had won. You know, he deserved so much. And I think what it showed was just that there was so much importance about, you know, the right sizing, the right ships. But to have two unique people with Shimi and Igor, it didn't matter. They were completely the wrong size. And they made it work at the highest level. And I think that showed the fleet what was possible. You know, when I first started 470, I was taller than my brother. So it was quite a similar situation. I certainly didn't have the height that Shimi had. But, you know, what an amazing demonstration for our class that you can tune your rig, you can get the right sail package. If you sail well, you know, you can win the games. And I think that was a great message for the fleet to really focusing on getting two of the right personalities in the boat. And whether that meant maybe the sizing is not ideal, that partnership, that decision-making, that friendship will get you over the line. And I think that was a really, really great message. I certainly prefer having a very tall crew. It means that I need to hike as much. So everyone's got their preference. But yeah, it was great to see.
Yeah, awesome performance by them. And you had to do a bit of fighting in the medal race to get that silver medal, didn't you?
Yeah, you know, that week was pretty tough for us. We had quite a difficult build up, I guess, the last sort of 6-7 months, both balancing family and campaign. And, you know, that week with the storm that came through and the damaged equipment, we had, obviously there was quite a few protests during that week. But, you know, by the time we got to the medal race, we were certainly looking forward to the games finishing. But you know, it was a great moment. It was a really good test for Will and I. We knew that we were guaranteed a medal coming in, no matter what, whatever position we held for the medal race. And that's just such an amazing feeling and comfort to know that you can really put everything on the line and still come away with, you know, with an Olympic medal. And I think Will loves swimming. He swims a lot as a cross training, and when he fell out a little bit during the games, we in that moment, you know, I looked at him and I said, mate, it's just not a good time to go swimming right now. So we jumped back in, had a little bit of a smile, and that's the only thing we ever said. We didn't really. I got away with calling him Splash for a little bit, and then that sort of wore off. But you know, it was a good moment to test ourselves, to test our partnership, and yeah, to come back and to get Borium on the last bottom mark and to fight all the way that last downwind to do everything that we could. You know, it was really cool to come away with this silver.
I want to go all the way back to the beginning, because I'm sure a lot of people are thinking, well, you were always born to this, and you know, with that many world titles, you must have been winning when you were in your teens. But it wasn't quite like that, was it? Just tell us a little bit about what first got you into, what made you aspire to Olympic campaigning in the first place? Who were your heroes? Who were your inspirations? And how did the journey begin?
Yeah, I guess the pivotal moment for me was the Sydney Olympics. We'd just come back from the 420 World Championships, which we won in that year. And I went over to Europe in Kiel. We did a 420 event over there and met Jenny and Belinda and Tom. And I'd always followed particularly Tom King quite closely, that we shared a junior coach together. A junior coach always talked about Tom, how great Tom was and what he was doing and his journey. And you know, I'd sort of followed his events, tried to see him in the boat park as much as I could and try and talk to him. And it was really, you know, that Sydney Olympics, having it in Australia, having the success in 470 for Australia at those games was a real turning point for me to carry the Olympic flag during the closing ceremony as well. So I got to really experience that atmosphere and that vibe, unlimited sport for 2 weeks, staying in the village. You know, it was a pretty, pretty cool moment for an 18-year-old. And you know, that was really the turnaround for me. Victor said to me, hey, let's go to Europe. Said to mum and dad, I'd enrolled in my law and business degree, and I was already 6 weeks into it. And what a choice, right? To, you know, to go to Europe, travel around the world, or to get knuckled into to do my do studies. And you know, made the decision to go to Europe. And I guess, you know, the rest is part of the journey.
And who were you sailing with at the time?
I was sailing with my brother. We had sailed together for the last couple of years in 420s from the junior boats. And I think it was an easy thing, in the sense that finding the right partnership, particularly at an early age, who has the same drive and commitment, you know, it was a little bit easier to convince banker mum and dad to help us get over to Europe. And I think doing that together, you know, as a family for the first couple of years, my parents came on tour, and I was too young to drive. I think the biggest cultural shock for me I was living with Victor when we were training down in Sydney. And it was quite an experience to live with Victor for half a year in year one. But yeah, it was good experience.
Any insights into why that was quite an experience? Was it Eastern European food? What was it?
It was a bit of Eastern European culture. As I was 18 years old, when we leave school, we have quite a large party. And, you know, I think Victor tried to cut my party into half and wanted to go 470 training. But it was just Victor's approach. You know, he tests you regularly, and he tests you in ways that you don't necessarily realize at the time. I think after 20 years you get a little bit better about identifying some of those key moments or some of the bigger picture stuff. But certainly, you know, in the beginning he was testing our commitment, and it was really interesting journey from that part. But you know, no normal TV, no real partying. It was sailing videos, sailing books, a lot of discussion, and I guess looking back at it, that time together was really instrumental for helping in those pressured moments at the games, whether it's in between races, whether it's after races, whether it's those highs and lows that you experience in sport, is that we always knew that we had each other, and we had the same in my sailing partners as well.
And what did you need to work on? We've all got the dirty side of our VARs that we like to try and ignore, as Hamish says, and the Road to Gold course. What needed polishing? What did you work out for yourself? Maybe what did Victor point out to you?
I think it's a question of what doesn't need working. You know, that's the thing about sailing, is that there's so many ways that once you think you've got a good understanding, then you have a different level of experience, and then you come back and revisit it again at a you know, slightly different level, and you basically just get deeper and deeper into topics. You know, the topics necessarily don't change, but your understanding and your level of understanding increases, which means that you can get more enjoyment out of, or we found, you know, that I guess that really deep understanding and enjoyment to see the situation unfold, whether that was on the race course or whether that was in our preparation. And that was some of the key part for us to stay motivated, to stay hungry, to really try and, you know, at the end, keep up with some of the amazing talent that's you know, coming forward through this next generation of 470 sailors. You know, it was just a matter of trying to hold, I guess, hold our ground and to keep fighting, but keep learning, keep being open enough, but also have a bit of wisdom to build on our past experiences.
Hamish, the Australians had a real breakthrough as a sailing team at Sydney 2000. Obviously, by the time that they got to Sydney 2000, Tom King and Mark Turnbull had to be among the favourites. But a couple of years before that, probably no one would have picked them. What was your takeaway from seeing the Australian performance in Sydney?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a real insight from that here, you know, just what was going on behind the scenes. And I think I remember talking to them right after they'd got the gold medal, and we sat down with Tom King, and I think I brought this up on Road to Gold, just shooting the breeze. And I remember him saying, and it was kind of one of those sort of silent moments, that did he just say that? You know, it was, and Tom said, look, you know, I sort of feel now that there's still so much to learn in the 470. You know, like, I'm only just unraveling the whole mystery or mystique of the 470. And it was a really interesting eye-opening question. Answer for my question was, you know, where to from here? Well, you know, he was retiring and he was quite happy to say that, but it was really motivational at the time. Just his understanding that there was still so much left on the table, having just successfully won the gold medal.
Matt, if I may say so, you've already said Tom was a bit of an inspiration for you. I mean, he came, I think, if I remember, in the that sort of four-year period leading up to Sydney 2000, his results at the Worlds went something like 40th, 20th, 10th, 1st. And, I mean, one of the things that he said is one of the most inspirational things that I think I've heard was, we trained and trained until talent was no longer an issue. So can you just put that comment into perspective and how you see that?
Yeah, I can really resonate with that. And I think to be successful at the games, you need to sort of take that approach. You know, this difference between how much training that you do and your mentality or the psychology for your training and for your preparations, as opposed to when we talk about natural talent, you sort of have the assertion that it's, you can probably get away with not training as much. But I think at Olympic level, everyone's talented in some way. Some sailors are more, probably a little bit more naturally talented than others. But, you know, the volumes of training, if you keep training hard, you have a good approach, you have a good plan, then, you know, you'll tick a lot of those boxes, and it just won't be a disadvantage, I guess, anymore. And you know, Tom's an engineer, you know, he's extremely bright. He had a pretty similar, I guess, introduction to 470, obviously different times than myself with his approach. I wasn't winning really, you know, you're talking about Sabos or Optimist class yeah, I wasn't winning national championships. I was in the top six, top seven. And it was only really later on that with you know, hard work, with right coaches, that you're able to sort of make some of those steps to build up at those junior levels. And Tom was extremely hardworking. I got fortunate enough to have a little bit of time with him early on in my career, and you know, we stay in touch regularly. But you know, his approach certainly set the benchmark, and I guess put the stake in the ground for 470s in Australia to say, hey, you know, I've started the legacy. You guys continue it, and you know, you always need someone to start it. And I think, you know, Tom and Jenny, you know, Belinda and Mark were that group to sort of start the vision and give the rest of us the inspiration to continue.
Jenny, I'm not going to bring you in today. It would be an appropriate time to do so, but I've lent on you far too hard. So you just sit back and enjoy the conversation today. But nice to see you on the call, Jenny.
Oh, great.
If you change your mind, Jenny, if you want to say hello to Matt, you're very welcome. But Jenny's one of our regulars, and it's been great to hear her insights into the build up to Sydney 2000 as well. Now, we've got a question from Mike Madge. So, Mike, if you'd like to come in and ask your question directly to Matt.
Hi, Matt. I've heard a lot about you. You've been pretty successful. Congratulations. I'm just wondering, what do you do? Any other sailing? Are you pretty focused on the 470, or have you thought like beyond that, like a lot of the Olympic guys getting into Sail GP and America's Cup? Any of that on the horizon for you?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And it's something that it's been a bit of a struggle over the last few years, as I've got older in terms of Olympic sailing, that Australia's approach for Olympic campaigning is very much that if you want to do an Olympic program, then you do an Olympic program. And for me, it's something that's almost been a non-negotiable for Victor. So it's made it very difficult. Whatever spare time that we had, or any of the other events that we wanted to do in a professional sense, you know, there's always been a bit of a pushback to make sure that we spend more time in 470. And I think the hard part also is when you are trying to balance, you know, family, being married, and at the older end of Olympic sailing career. You know, I've always had the dream that I've wanted to get more into the professional space. And I guess that opportunity is easier now, but it's in the past. It's been very, very difficult. I've done a little bit of moth sailing. I've done a little bit of small amount of ocean sailing. You know, a bit of Etchell sailing, and other classes, but not campaigning those classes. Yeah,
which seems quite different, for example, to Tom Slingsby and the build up to London 2012, or Nathan Outridge and Anderson in the build up to London 2012. So you being much more specialised in the 470 from what you've just said, whereas they seem to diversify quite a bit. So any any pangs of envy watching those guys go off and do other things?
You know, it's a really close group, you know, and I think, you know, as we all came into London, the London Games, we were all actually focused on Olympic, you know, and I think Tommy went to the America's Cup straight after the London Olympics, and Nathan was very much training with Pete and Blair, and, you know, a lot in Australia, and for that build up. I guess it's what happens after, you know, they really made the decision with their coaches to be able to do other forms of sailing as well, and move a little bit more into that professional sense and have that balance. Unfortunately, Tommy went out of Olympic. You know, he went straight into the professional scene, and continued obviously with Goobs, and started to have that balance and that partnership. And I think, you know, the modern day Olympic campaign is semi part time. When you look at some of the really experienced crews that are coming in, that they're sort of part-time Olympic, part-time professional, and having that balance. But what it does show you is that if you have two unique people that have the ability to stay, come in and out of Olympic together, and when that partnership is being enhanced in a professional sense, it makes it possible. You know, when you're as a helm, or if you don't have that environment that, you know, that your Olympic partner can't come with you in a professional sense, then I think it adds a lot of complication. And ultimately, you know, we've found that it's been very hard to continue the success and you know, to get the medals, which is ultimately what you're trying to achieve.
And you touched on family just then, and what also stands out is what an amazing job you've managed to do, balancing family life with extremely successful professional life. So just tell us what your secrets have been there.
I wouldn't say secrets, very understanding wife. You know, I think, yeah, we're probably today or tomorrow we'll have four kids. So there's a lot of, there's certainly a lot happening on the family front. But, you know, for me, you know, to go through that journey with my partner, with Riki, my wife, and we've been together for 20 years. So we started Olympic campaigning together, and for the first 12 years, we traveled the world. We followed our Olympic ambitions, and for her to go to the games in London for Germany, you know, was really a dream come true for us to do that together. And then, you know, life sets in, and you know, my wife and I've always wanted to have a larger family and to be based at home, to be able to work from home and to support our kids and to not miss those key moments in family. And that's a personal choice. You know, we we've been able to, I guess, you know, make that work over the years. It's been hard. It's been very difficult with the extensive travel as I've got older. You know, particularly where we've had to spend a lot of time in Europe or Japan, and I had to quarantine for four times. So, you know, to spend 8 weeks locked up was pretty hard, to miss those parts. And I think as priority sets in with COVID and with your preparations, you know, it's just a balancing act. But to have a really super amazing supporting crew, as in Will, super amazing supportive, you know, wife and coach, to know my circumstance and to tailor our program that has enough flexibility, that has enough focus, that, you know, to get the best out of me, and that is very different to what might be to get the best out of another athlete without, you know, those family circumstances. But, you know, there's no special moment when your kids can see you on TV and to be so excited that you go in after the games into their schools and you can see that inspiration. And I think it's been nice to know that they understand why I'm away, and I guess the significance and the aspirations and the dreams that I've been trying to instill to my kids, you know, for them to really see that from Tokyo and to be old enough to understand that, you know, that's been amazing.
How old are the kids?
Anton just turned 8. Amelie is 6, and Zoe is 3. And we're only a couple of days away, or maybe today.
Yeah, maybe today. Now, Chris Tang has got a relevant question for talking about young people, and we're on the verge of the Youth Sailing World Championships taking place in Amman. Matt, did you ever go to an ISAF Youth Worlds, as it would have been back then?
No, I finished 3 times second, so we didn't get the qualification. Yeah,
I'm nevertheless going to ask you before I get Chris in. Well, Chris, come in and join us now anyway, if you want to ask your question directly. But what advice and tips would you have for any of the kids going to represent their nation next week at sort of effectively a mini Olympic regatta in Amman?
Yeah, I would just say just really enjoy the experience. You know, the one thing that I've loved to, and the reason why I've continued for so long is that environment, you know, a little bit of that pressure of those big moments. To be selected for a Youth World Championships is an amazing experience. But don't take too much pressure from it. I think enjoy those partnership, those sailors that you're racing against are most likely probably the sailors that you will be racing against in, you know, through your Olympic journey, whether that's from the bottom end of the fleet from, and then the middle end of the fleet and then the top end of the fleet. You know, those partnerships, those friendships, you know, it's an amazing experience. And I think, you know, well done, and just savor the moment.
Hamish, any comments from you? A Youth Worlds winner, and you've been there as coach many, many times with enormous success. What's your message to the youth going to Amman next week?
Yeah, not much different to Matt's, really. You know, you have taken five teams away, and yeah, I think the key to the success of those teams was, you know, looking back, was just keeping it sort of really normal, just normalizing the whole experience, you know, not getting overwhelmed or underwhelmed. Just, you know, it's so often you hear people say, oh, well, yeah, it's just another regatta. But I think it's quite hard to achieve that, just another regatta. And so you need the kind of people around you to bring that, you know, to the front, you know, with normalizing it. Familiar people or regular contact with familiar people is going to help a lot. And just being prepared for the fact that it is a circus, but what you've got to achieve within that circus is to normalize the event itself. And your goal is just to sail the best you can sail, and nothing else. You know, you don't want to be looking at the results, or, you know, you have no idea how you're going to fare, really, because it's for a lot of people, it's the first time they're back out in competition. So there's pointless in thinking about the performance in terms of results. You just want to think about your performance in terms of just being the best you can be.
Great. Thank you very much for that. Chris, if you do want to come in and ask your question directly, then please do. I'm just going to give you a moment. Otherwise, I'm going to ask it anyway. And that's to ask you, Matt, what would you say is the best way to transition from the youth classes into the higher level classes? How did you make that transition? I think you partially answered the last bit, but yeah, just address Chris's question there.
Yeah, I think just having really good dialogue to your national federation or to the national coach. I'm talking about youth classes at a national level, but if it is at a state level, or a regional level, then just having really good dialogue with the coach or the supporting group for that next level. And I think without that dialogue, you can tend to transition a little bit too early or potentially a little bit too late. But I know for me, that transition from 420 to 470 was really enhanced by having good communication with the coach of that next level, and I guess saying, hey, you know, I'm here. Yeah, I'm really motivated. I want to go into that national or that next stage, and, you know, put you on the radar. And I think that communication is really key, because they'll be able to guide you in the right way, but also be able to identify, you know, the right time or the right moment to make that transition. So I would, you know, try and defer the decision to the coach of that next level. I think it's probably the best way.
We've got a 470 specific question from Dominic, but actually I just want to announce the fact that we've been in close conversation with the 470 international class president, Andreas, and if you'd like to come in, Andreas, it'd be great to get you in, because in the new year we want to launch a special edition Road to Gold, specifically aimed at 470 sailors, and we'd like to do that in many other fleets as well. And we're already getting a lot of enthusiasm for the idea within the 470 fleet, and we'll talk about some of the other classes that we've been speaking to in the coming weeks. But Andreas, if you're around, great to get you in. Otherwise, it's just to say, Dominic, we are going to be addressing 470 specific questions, and also Nicolas Guichet, you sent in some great questions. We're going to be talking about that. Matt, obviously the big question is, it's going to mixed for the next time round. I think I sort of know the answer, but what are your thoughts? What are your plans for Paris 2024?
I haven't made any final decision. You know, coming back from the games, I've certainly really enjoyed being in my home, you know, obviously the home environment. I'm not going anywhere to be. So, you know, so into, you know, the kids and the schooling and everything else. And it's something that I've struggled with personally for a long time in my career. So I don't have any ambition to go anywhere at this stage, but you know, I'll be having to make a formal, I guess, decision early next year once our contracts have sort of come to expiration. So I've got a little bit of time, and the team have been amazing. You know, we talked about this a couple of years ago. We talked about my family, you know, family situation and time after the games, and they've continued to support me over the I guess the 6 months post games, and they've certainly given me a little bit of space to enjoy just being at home, and then we can sit down together and work out what Paris does or doesn't look like, and in what role.
So the big question that everyone has been grappling with in the NACRA 17 over the last number of years is which way round do you sail, male, female, or female, male, front to back of the boat? What are your thoughts in terms of how, you know, do you think there's going to be a type forming in the 470, or does it come down to different factors? Maybe the factors we were talking about earlier with Shemi Fantella and Igor Marinic, for example.
Yeah, I was going to mention that. You know, I think if you've got two great individuals, whether that's male or female, I think you're going to be successful. You know, we can see that. You know, the female level is the same as the male level, and I think what's great about the class is that for the last 20 years we've had the same equipment. And it's the only Olympic class that has exactly the same equipment for men and women. So a lot of our training for the smaller nations without, you know, large volumes of boats, we would regularly do all our training together, and we regularly swap as well. So you know, I think it's a great thing for the class. It would have been great in terms of numbers to keep, you know, men and women separate, but you know, I think to have it mixed certainly is an amazing opportunity to mix those talents across the fleets. I think the fleet will get extremely strong. And I think it's going to be a really interesting journey. I don't think it's going to preference any particular size or combination. You know, I think a lot of, if you look at it on paper, you would probably say that, you know, having a lighter helm and a stronger male crew, particularly with pumping. But you know what we've seen in some of the results that are coming through, it's the opposite. And I think that mix will definitely be there. And you know, I don't think there's any real preference. No doubt that the sailors like Hannah Mills will be given it a very good run. You know, so I think it's going to be an interesting journey for the class, and I hope that the class can really focus on that celebration of coming together and the quality of the fleet and the depth of the fleet as those two separate disciplines merge as one. I think it'll be extremely strong and if not one of the strongest Olympic classes out there.
It's a short run into the next games, obviously, and so that's a lot to learn when the class is changing so significantly. You told me that you've already been through the Road to Gold course a little bit before, so you know what the course is all about. Just give us your thoughts on that in terms of one of the things that Hamish has aimed to get across with the course is how much work you can get done away from the race course. You don't have to be doing the whole regatta scene month in and month out. Just give us your insight on that.
Yeah, I think, you know, COVID, particularly for Australia and I guess New Zealand, really highlighted, or I guess forced us to focus more domestically. And I think when you're looking to campaign, the easy option is actually follow those European tours to do multiple events, because it gives you a very clear structure for a program. You know the dates, you know how to prepare, you follow similar models. But, you know, that domestic-based training was something that was really enjoyable, something that historically we've been terrible at, to stay really focused, to stay motivated when we've only got one boat or two boats to train against, and to keep the right intensity to make use of that time. But, you know, I think what's great about the Road to Gold is that it brings the sailors together. It provides a platform to share, you know, unique knowledge, to share detailed knowledge at the level of whether that's a sailor looking to prepare for its state championships or national championships, or whether it's sailors that are multiple Olympic medalists looking in and you know, trying to refresh a lot of those topics or to gain that knowledge. So, you know, and I think it's a really important thing for Olympic sailing, and certainly have to commend you guys on you know, making this possible for a lot of the sailors that potentially don't have, you know, those coaches for 20 years or those extreme experienced coaches that some federations or some national teams have, that this knowledge can be transferred and to give multiple sailors that opportunity to share, and the athletes that have come in and had these talks, you know, have been really, really inspirational, I'm sure have helped your followers. And yeah, I think it's great.
That's very kind of you. Thank you very much, Matt. One of those, it was Amory Rindham, and she talked about legacy and sort of also your values, what you stand for. And so it's not just the medals that you win, but it's the way that you win them as well, and what that says about you as a person. And I'm sure that you, as a father of 3 9/10 children, think about that a lot as well. So how do you want your children to see you with what you've achieved, and what does Matt Belcher represent beyond the medals and the world titles that he's won?
It's a good question. Yeah, I'd like to think my kids are, you know, having a clear focus, so having some, you know, determination, you know, being humble, and being kind, and but I think, yeah, just to have a purpose, follow, trust yourself, to have a dream, and to have the courage to go and to do it. And I think that's the biggest thing that I've learned with Olympic sailing is that, you know, most kids will have a dream or particular passion early on, but not everyone has that opportunity to actually dive in and say, hey, let's do it, and then get the right people, the right support to be able to make. And for me, if, you know, whether my kids are interested in sport or whether they're interested in anything that, you know, whatever they want to be, I would like to give them that same opportunity and for them to have that same passion in whatever they choose to do something that they love. For, you know, for me, it's I've spent more time Olympic campaigning than I haven't. So it's, you know, it's a fantastic journey for me, and I can't thank my, you know, my parents and my wife and my sailing community and everyone along the way to allow me to have that. And I, you know, I think as a family, we've been really fortunate to make that work.
Two words that stood out there for me, Matt, that you wouldn't necessarily think are intrinsic to the kind of success that you've had: being humble and being kind. How is it possible to achieve everything that you've done with humility and kindness?
It's a lot of it is about the journey, and I'm sure a lot of the athletes that have come through, it's not about yes, it's obviously, you know, about winning Olympic medals and being an Olympic champion and everything else, but as you go through my 5 Olympic campaigns, you realize there's a lot of highs and lows, there's a lot of disappointment, there has been a lot of success, but it's that partnership, it's those moments when you're talking or communicating with your sailing partner and you've completely stuffed it up, or you've done something that you just can't believe is possible, you know, that last reach in at the games, in the meta race, or even our approach for that last race for the meta race, you know, it was the last time that we could race together. It wasn't, you know, obviously there was a lot of risk to try and go out and win the race or anything else, and we just said to each other, let's just go and enjoy the moment. And I think whether that's those memories of the games, whether that's memories of London, they're the things that you carry forward, and they're the things that you learn from and you enjoy and you appreciate much more as you get older. The Olympic medal is amazing. It lives in my sock drawer, I try to take it out to the junior sailors and to show it as much as I can. But it's those memories and that partnership and that friendship. And you know, I've got a lot of friends probably on this call, and to share that moment, you know, on the standing on the dice, that all six of us hugging each other and supporting each other. You know, that's one of the biggest memories that I'll carry for sure.
I haven't had the honour of meeting your brother Dan, but he's doing all right for himself, I hear. He's actually your boss at Yachting Australia, right?
Yeah, that's right. He's 18 months older. He's the president of Australian Sailing, so he's very involved. He's quite deep into, as the president. He's very deep into the Olympic space. But you know, it's a family journey, and you know, for me, being campaigning for 20 years, it's mum and dad have been absolutely hugely involved, and my brother and you know, my sisters, my family. It's a big part of it, whether that's coming over and supporting at the games themselves or all of those moments in between. I guess it was fitting that he wanted to come into the sailing space, and I'm sure both of us will be involved for the many years to come.
We haven't even spoken in any detail about Malcolm Page and Will Ryan, but maybe we will get them on another Q&A call another time. But they are absolutely top blokes, and it's always been a pleasure to hang out with you, Matt, whoever you've been campaigning with. You're such a gentleman, and the humility and kindness comes across, and to be able to achieve everything you've done and keep that sort of gentle demeanor about yourself has been really, really impressive. We've just gone past the hour. We don't like to go past the hour, and we've got more questions coming in. But I think in answer to your question, Timofey, about books and any other recommendations or study, we're going to ask Matt that, and we'll get back to you. We'll put out a message on the Facebook group about that. Hamish, any observations from you before we let Matt run off to the hospital?
That was amazing, Matt. It's just incredible. Every time, you know, I ask somebody or we ask somebody to come on, the first incredible thing is that you say yes. I go, wow, that's so cool. And when people like yourself come on and really, you know, really genuinely offer help and encouragement and support and information, I just get blown away. And again, I have been blown away by what's come through. So thank you very much, and enjoy the next journey, which probably starts today or tomorrow. And
yeah, I hope to catch up. Yeah, well, sounds great.
Matt, we're going to have to do a part two sometime, because Andreas has dropped into the chat box about how he remembers the portable barbecue in the airport. So we're going to have to do a follow up on that and find out about that. We have got some legends on the call. Igor Marinich, nice to see you on the call. My old friend John Dransfield, Australian fireball legend, great to see you, mate. And thank you for all of you for joining us. I hope you've enjoyed it. Thanks to those of you that put questions in the box. Sorry, I didn't get to all of them. Most of all to you, Matt, particularly on the verge of becoming a dad for the fourth time. Thank you so much. It's been amazing. Just a last word from you. Last word from you, and we'll let you go, Matt. But what are your thoughts going into the next year? What are you most looking forwards to?
Well, I think I'll be bunkered down for a while. We're about to have school holidays next year. For me, you know, in terms of the sailing front, I'm doing a fair bit of Etchell sailing. So we're looking to campaign for the Etchell Worlds in Cowes towards the end of next year. And also looking to do the Sydney to Hobart next year on a TP52. So I'm starting, restarting that journey, because we haven't been able to do any training or anything for next year. So I'm looking forward to getting a little bit more into the professional sailing space. And a lot of those programs are based in Australia. So that's sort of on the next horizon. And the next part is to, we didn't talk about, I saw a question there about funding and how do you fund your Olympic program. I have a development company. So we do small scale developments, and I run that from home, and have been for the last four to five years. And that's how I help fund our Olympic program, and provide for my family and give me a lot of flexibility. So that's on the horizon, and I'll be focusing on that for the next sort of 6 months, 6 to 12 months.
Awesome. And you'll obviously be massively successful at that as well, Matt. Thank you very much. We will be back to you next week with another amazing sailor, but this has been a fantastic session. Once again, thank you, everybody. Thank you, Matt Belcher, and good night.
See you guys.